made the important point this afternoon in following the exercise when they said attraction, I feel, seems to be about an absence of love. A little bit this absence of love and explore a little bit what is this mysterious thing that we call love. Before, being here for these days is like a microcosm of our everyday life. Even though the details are different, what we notice running in our being are the things that run in our being regardless of where we are. And if we look carefully, we might be struck, we might be shocked by love. I spoke a little bit last night about this capacity to be harsh with ourselves, more so than we are even with anyone else. And sometimes even in very subtle ways. I wonder if you've noticed when the mind has got a bit distracted in meditation, what happens in the moment when you realize? That realizing is very, very significant. So the good news is every time you get lost, fantastic, it's an opportunity for that significant moment of coming back. If really understood, we would feel a deep gladness. Life miraculously wakes us up. Oh, I was distracted, then I became aware. But it's not really true. I was so busy thinking about something, I wasn't really around to come back. But life is very kind to us. Life, it's a little bit anthropomorphic to say, but anthropomorphic means to personalize. Love can't really be personalized, but life can't. But it's like love cares for us so much that it keeps on bringing us back. No matter how many crazy stories I get lost in, life keeps saying hello. And we're ready to see that mechanism as it truly is, we would be overcome with gratitude to life, with wonder at how much life cares for us. It is what often happens in the moment we wake up, is we say, oh, I shouldn't have been there. How long was I gone for? We start measuring our meditation maybe in terms of how much time we're present and how much time we're absent. And often we find the percentages to be less than satisfying. And we have the idea then that progress or success in meditation would be less and less absent and more present. More significant than how much time you are present to your breathing is what moment of waking up, moment of realizing that you've been gone. Look and see what you do in waking up. What's the mechanism? What's the attitude? I call it a lack of love. By some harshness. A voice that seems to have an idea for us of how we should be doing it. A voice that, not just in meditation, but seems to run through our life, telling us how we should be, how good we should be, how bad we are. A voice that measures, controls, evaluates how it thinks we're doing. The tradition that I practice in calls that voice the superego. And Freud called it the Uber-ich, the Uber-ich, Uber-ich. Which means the Uber-ich, over-I. The overseer, we could say. A little bit psychological. The Buddha also had a name for that voice. He called it Mara. Well, in Hindi, which has evolved from Sanskrit and Pali, Marna means to beat. Mara is the beater. You should be like this. Why aren't you like that? Look at the others. Quality sometimes. In that voice. Complains, measures, judges, evaluates, compares. Compares us either to others, or compares us to some ideal we hold for ourselves that we have somehow internalized that we should live up to. We have to look for ourselves and see what the particular characteristics of our Mara Uber-ich superego is. Instructive, and maybe it's even reassuring to think of the Buddha being pursued by Mara. It's common, at least in Indian tradition, it's common to externalize facets of the inner life. So Mara is referred to as some external figure. Just like in Christianity, the devil is referred to as some external figure. Tradition, it's more common to internalize the various parts of the being and refer to it as a voice in my head, for example. Although, quite often with this kind of structure, we may experience it internally or externally. It may feel, that voice of complaint and measurement and judgment, like something that's happening inside. It might feel like something that's happening outside. It may be experienced as like it's almost an over-the-shoulder, whispering-in-the-ear voice. Look at what you just did. For example, what do they think of you? Might be another. Main characteristics of this controlling structure is that it's dry, cold, hard, doesn't really do love. So we exist often in conflict, feeling this structure as a pressure over us. To live up to an ideal, or to compare favourably to others. And rather tragically, it seems no matter what we do, it's never good enough. The bar just gets higher. He was sitting under the tree where he was awakened. Mara. So in the language that the Buddha used in the text, Mara came to him. And we might say that that inner voice of doubt or criticism arose. And first, it says in the text, Mara tempted him with all kinds of things. He tempted him with ideas of wealth and fame as a great guru. But he abided equanimous. He tempted him with visions of dancing girls. I wonder if anyone's had visions of dancing girls or dancing boys. Sexual fantasy life. Springing up sometimes rather abided, equanimous. And then the Buddha, and then Mara, switched tactics. Switched tactics of doubt, which again I referred to a bit last night. that critical voice, that evaluating, gives you the right to think you could get enlightened. What makes you think you could be a great meditator? Why did you bother coming here? The same thread. Buddha, rather. The Buddha touched the ground. And in the text, slightly overlaid maybe by legend, but the Buddha called the earth as his witness, as his right to full human life, a liberated human life. Confronted by that inner voice of criticism. And it may be useful to metaphorically touch the earth and just to have a sense of something vast, something in which we can trust, larger than our own pettiness. Sometimes our world can get filled up by harshness, criticism, to look wider than our own being. And a sense of the way life can hold us. That maybe our own confused, fragile mind can't quite hold us in that moment. It can't hold us because there's no love there. On touching the earth, I just have a sense from the text of the Buddha recognizing the earth, supporting him, literally. Supporting, allowing us to be here. It's rather a beautiful metaphor for love. Love is that which... Talk about love. Conventionally, we have a rather reductive sense of it, I think. And I asked Leela earlier, what was the Hebrew word for love? And she told me, ahava. And I was curious to see when I asked her the word, like in English, love, or whether there was a variety of words to bring out different shades of love. But she says, ahava is pretty much equivalent to the English word love. No? So in some other languages, and in some spiritual traditions, there's much more discernment, much more distinguishing the shades of love, which I think are important. Even in Greek, eros and agape, and the others that I've forgotten, but which point to different movements that we kind of lump together in a sort of convenient lump and call ahava, or love. But the love of friendship is kind of different than the love of romance, which is kind of different from the love for, I feel, in looking out at the sunset or feeling a sense of connection with the desert. The way we usually... The kind of holy grail of love mostly seems to do with romantic love. There's endless songs. How many songs are written about romantic love? And how many songs are written about the love of the sunset and the desert? The love that can abide in the heart, feeling connected with all things. Not many. How many songs are written about the love of getting together with a man or a woman, or breaking up from a man or a woman? All the rest. It's like we're fixated on that kind of love. Most people's sense of the pinnacle experience of love seems to be in that relationship. And so much of our culture is fixated on that relationship, the romantic relationship, and success in that relationship. And whole industries thrive on that relationship. We relate all areas, so many areas of our life, to that relationship. If you look at advertising, they use the hope of that sense of love to sell anything. This car will give you success in love. Even this mobile phone, success in love. These clothes, this hairstyle, this makeup, these whatever it is. All being pushed on the fact that somehow what you'll get from this phone is love. Because the person in the advert's going on the phone. Shampoo. This shampoo will give you love. If only it was true, it would be fantastic. But no chance. Relationship, we talk about love as if it was a state we exist in. We say, I love you. That's as if we exist in a state of love. Even though if we look, a lot of the time what we're doing is not loving them. A lot of the time what we're doing is, subtly or not so subtly, trying to manipulate them. Often if we look carefully, and it may be painful to look in this way, what we mean when we say I love you is a bit more like, as long as you do what I want you to do, I love you. As long as your behaviour conforms to my image of what I think it should be, or what I want to get from you, then I'll extend some warm feeling towards you. But as soon as that changes, as soon as your behaviour steps outside of my version of what it should be like, then I'll experience a whole different set of feelings to you, called resentment, blame, agitation, etc. And we call that love. In fact, you could say the same controlling structure, Mara, the same voice of measurement and comparison and judgment that we extend inwardly, we easily extend to those around us. And we seem to extend with the most charge to the people the very closest to us, to the ones actually we care the most about. It's not to deny, of course, the genuine closeness, warmth, and intimacy that can flow between two people. The warmth and intimacy of romance, of sexual love, as well as the warmth and intimacy that can be there in friendship, the warmth and intimacy that can be there with people, with places, and with situations. So what characterizes actually the love when it's flowing, rather than what we call love, but we've actually something quite kind of manipulative or unclear? Is a softening or a transparency or a dropping away of the boundaries between me and another. Experience and see where that's true. Few moments can be with somebody, or it could be in some situation. It could be just as equally in being with a lover, or being with a friend, or sitting outside looking at the desert, or any other situation. And sometimes there's a sense of ease, action. And the normally strong boundaries of here I am, doing my thing, and worrying about this and that, and you're over there, and softens, drops away. and we feel somehow included with the person, with the desert, included with life. Maybe in our meditation, like breathing. Think of our relationship to breathing as one of that runs along this span between judgment and evaluation on one side, where the boundaries are most rigid, and love at the other end of the spectrum, where the boundaries are completely dissolved. But actually, moment by moment, our breathing is a pretty good gauge of the presence of love. So feeding the breathing, but in a rather hard or harsh or judgmental way, can manufacture all kinds of thoughts about how it should be, how long should it be, how deep should it be, how much should breathing. Maybe that one I had a few breaths ago was quite good. Seems better than this one. You see, the boundaries between the sense of self, of who I am, and of breathing as something I'm doing are very, very strong in that relationship. And then there may be moments you might be very deeply touched by such a sense of intimacy with breathing that one's whole experience is undivided. Breathing, the noticing, the feeling of the breathing, the sense of the expansion and contraction, all's happening together. There's no issue about inside and after. The boundaries of space, inside and outside, and the boundaries of time, before and after, it doesn't matter so much in that moment. That intimacy with that undivided sense of being, I would say, is an intimation of love. About four kinds of love, particularly. And they're often not translated as the four kinds of love, but that's how I'd like to translate them. Translated are the four divine abidings. Do you understand? Again, it's a little convoluted English. Divine, godly, heavenly, abidings, places to hang out. Divine places to hang out. The other way they're translated, or the Buddha referred to them, as the four boundless conditions of the heart. Boundless means limitless. Limitless. Limitless heart. The unbounded heart. Undivided. The heart that isn't judging and criticizing and measuring and complaining. Sorry. Watch off to make sure I don't speak too long. Here with them, maybe not, but I'll describe them. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upeka in the Pali. Metta, probably maybe familiar with. Metta is what the Buddha called deep friendliness. It's often translated as loving kindness, which personally I find a little bit sugary. But if you like it's fine. But that sense of goodwill, actually, I think is a very good translation. Goodwill. A sense of well-wishing. And sometimes, particularly when people practice in a group like this, there's a meta field that builds up, particularly at the end of the retreat. And then people feel, if you've done retreats before, you notice there's a sense of really feeling you care for these other people. Really sensing that you wish them well. And it's a very beautiful feeling. Goodwill, a deep one of the flavours of love that the Buddha says is limitless. Limitless means our capacity to wish well has no limits when the heart is unbounded by suspicion, by criticism, by measurement, by judgment. Anna, compassion. And it's a very good translation. Because compassion, in the root, which I think is Latin, com means with, and passion comes from suffer. So literally compassion means to suffer with. Sometimes we're really touched by the suffering of another. In all kinds of different circumstances. Maybe in the retreat that we see someone having a hard time. We may see someone in tears or looking rather kind of collapsed. And quite naturally, the heart goes out to them because we know what it's like to suffer and we don't like it. Actually feel, if we're sensitive, we can actually feel the suffering of another. If we see somebody being hit, if we're sensitive, there's a way in which we feel the pain of that. Or when we hear about somebody's very distressing situation, our face shows it. You say, and more than that, our heart feels it. And living in Israel, you must hear a lot about distressing situations. And far away, I hear a lot about distressing situations in Israel and around Israel. And if we're sensing of even, we don't even need to see it. Even if it's something distant, in hearing of the pain or the distress of another, a loved one, or even someone we don't even know. If we're sensitive to it, we feel that pain. That feeling is the evidence of an open heart. If our heart didn't go any further than here, how would we feel anything else? Why would it have any effect on us, what was happening over there? To them, to him or her. And when our boundaries are very rigid, when we're very defended, we don't feel it. Compassion isn't there. There's no room for compassion when we're busy distancing, separating, dividing ourselves off from others. Guidance, and is more inclusive, naturally we start to suffer with, to feel the pain of another, and to feel moved by it in empathy, or moved by it in action, depending on the circumstance. And the Buddha says this is one of the limitless conditions of the heart, the capacity to be in touch with, to be sensitive to be moved by the plight or the pain of others, is limitless. But a divine abiding. It may not, yeah.
So how can you explain if someone
sees well, that? I'm a little reluctant to get into the abstract, like if someone slips on a banana skin, but I'll try and respond briefly. Laughter is a covering mechanism because we're not capable of feeling. It's kind of uncomfortable or it's scary or it's threatening. if we're defended, it's threatening to feel the pain of another. Because the implications are, there's a whole world out there of people. Do I have to let them all in? No? So it's actually quite threatening, the idea of feeling the pain of another. So sometimes, when the heart's defended, we see someone in pain, there can be a laughter response. Actually, if we're sensitive, there won't be laughter. Even if others are laughing, there won't be laughter. There'll be seeing ourselves in that person's position, but not even as if that position was somehow over there. But feeling it. And if we really pay attention to that feeling, what we notice is it's life from two of us of our unbounded heart, of the fact that we're not really divided, separate, removed from others in the way that common sense tells us we are. And the Buddha says this is a divine abiding. But it may not sound divine, it may sound painful to be so impacted by all of that suffering. We have to look into our own hearts and look to our experience where we've been impacted deeply by the suffering of another. Something in us knows that response of the heart as authentic. And there's nothing more divine than the truth. It doesn't mean that it's comfortable. How could it be comfortable? Should it be comfortable to be confronted by the pain of another and not feel anything? But there's something more important than comfort. There's something deeper than or not feeling of something. And that something deeper is the vastness of the unbounded heart. The vastness, bigness, hugeness, limitlessness. However much pain we might be exposed to, it's never ever bigger than the heart that feels it. Limitless heart has room for everything, even the pain of the world. Open heart has room for that deep well-wishing of metta, and that deep feeling and responding of compassion. Mudita is another one. Mudita means appreciation, joy, but a particular kind, that extending joy. Again, it's not the joy of having something I like, it's the joy of the heart opening to include. And joy that we might notice in a simple way, for example, watching children play. There's no gratification in there for me, but seeing a child get an ice cream, or seeing a child enjoying with another child. Something in our heart, we feel the joy. Have an extraordinary capacity to experience joy on behalf of another. It's a very beautiful kind of joy. We live in a world where we're often presented with visions of happiness that are really about getting, having, becoming. Getting what I want, becoming who I want to be, having what I want. Either in a very gross material sense, or even the way we can, even our meditation practice can be all about my experiences. It's a rather coarse and selfish kind of pleasure. And yet, there's this access to a joy that's nothing to do with getting, having or becoming. It's the joy of appreciating. And the characteristic of it, in exactly the same way, is that the heart opens to include more of life. There's upekkha, equanimity. That capacity of heart to remain steady, to remain open, to remain receptive, regardless of what shows up in consciousness. Often we can be very, very selective about what we're prepared to open to. It means you go walking in the desert today, it's quite a hot day, there's a cliff here, and sort of gravel and rocks, and then there's green over there, green trees. We can be very selective about what we'll open to. I'll open to the green trees, until we get there and see there was no shade, but, okay, and it looks good from a distance. Or we can sit here in the open sun on the uncomfortable stones. Of course we prefer the green trees. But are we prepared to open to what life's offering us in that moment? There's no suggestion that we shouldn't prefer or that we shouldn't choose what is suitable. But our life can become extraordinarily narrow. Our comfort zone can become extraordinarily narrow. And the limits we place on what's acceptable can shrink and shrink and shrink. And often, rather sadly, as we get older and older and older, what's acceptable gets less and less and less. Until by the time we're old, we're really grumpy. Spiritual practice is about allowing that, what's tolerable, what's acceptable, what's welcomeable, to be vaster and vaster. I was mentioning to somebody yesterday how someone asked a teacher on their first retreat, they said, oh, I've got lots of pain in my legs, but I see others are sitting still. So if I do more retreats, if I sit more and more, will I have less pain? And the teacher said, no. But after a while, you won't mind so much. Actually, you will get a bit less pain in your legs after time. But much more significant, actually, than whether the body is comfortable or not, is the capacity to allow it. Life cannot be comfortable all the time. Nobody ever managed to have a life that was always comfortable. No amount of fame, no amount of wealth, no amount of power managed it. Look in these awful magazines that go on about rich people and famous people. What they show is that more wealth, more power, more misery, more confusion. But we believe so often that I can control my life and make it comfortable. And then when it's uncomfortable, we say, something's wrong. It's not fair. And we look for someone to blame. No? It's your fault. I'm sorry, not you, but... it's his fault. Or it's my fault. So the blame goes either inwardly, it's my fault, outwardly, it's your fault, or more generally, it's God's fault. Or it's life's fault. When we say, oh, it's not fair. And we're like, oh, it's not fair. Why me? As if life's somehow lining us up for... life's got it in for us. We're going to struggle on through our life, trying to make it comfortable, and failing every day, in one way or another. Meet what's there with the capacity to open our heart to it. the Buddha says, is a capacity that's limitless. There's no limits to what the heart can hold or make room for. And so these flavours, these four boundless states, I would say are flavours of love. And what's common in them is the sense of the enlarging of our being, the enlarging of what's possible, the enlarging of what we're touched by, the enlarging of what we can make room for. What's our relationship to love? I often see it as something that's coming from me to another. I'm loving. Or something that's coming from another to me. We see love as something that's going across a distance from one place to another, in other words. But actually, if we look at our experience of love, we find it's not that way at all. We find it's about an expansion of being. In the way that I just described, through the different four kinds of love. Feeling the joy of children, for example, or feeling the pain of another. If we look carefully, it's not that our heart or something called love comes out and goes to the child that's laughing or the child in pain. It's not that something comes out from the child in pain and comes over here and touches me. But somehow our being expands to include. It is the very essence of the spiritual life. And as such, the expansion of the heart, the capacity to include more and more, is the essence of the spiritual life. And actually more than that, in a rather mystical way, love is the essence of life itself. I invite you, after this talk, to sit outside and look up at the stars. Please don't try and find an answer. There's something profoundly mysterious about it. And there's only one response that really makes sense. It's the expanding of the being until what's here and what seems to be infinitely far out there are undivided. The boundless heart doesn't have anything left out or discluded. Nothing in the world of self, nothing that we call other, nothing that we call world. It's all included. Our connection to that is not so far away as it may seem. Those moments of feeling the pain of another, or those moments of feeling the joy of another, those moments of feeling deeply connected, are incredible pointers or indications of this expanding nature, this expansive nature that is actually our heart. Heart is a rather poor word because it seems to suggest some red lumpen thing in here. But that's not what we're talking about. The heart that we're talking about has no location. Although we tend to feel it most strongly here. of it. The heart has no location. It has no beginning and no end. And that limitless heart is what our practice is orientated towards. When we see the absence of love, when we see that measurement or that criticism, right behind that criticism, if we can feel it, what allows us even to feel it is the capacity to include, the capacity to make room for. Some ideas about how big that might have some idea of how much I can include others, their joy or their pain, of how much I can stretch my comfort zone to include the pleasant and the unpleasant. The vision of Dharma teachings, the goal of Dharma practice, and the alive possibility of human life is for love to be limitless. For the heartation for us is to make that unbound heart our own. To make that vision our own. For the welfare of each one of us, and for that of all beings everywhere. A few minutes, please feel free, and then we'll sit together just for a short time together before bed. Thank you.